Oh, brother, finally. Oh, gosh, it was a bad idea to get here at 6, and it was 6:25, and then I said, gosh, will this ever get here? My name's Zach. I'm an alcoholic from Houston, Texas, and I have some notes because this is a big deal for me, and it's not, well, let me start here. Harris asked me to do this about 6 months ago. And, you know, that's the perfect time to ask somebody to do this, because in the back of your mind, you say, okay, well, yeah, that's 6 months. That's not until June of 08. So, you know, that's no problem. But, you know, in the back of your head, you know, you start thinking right then, okay, well, what am I going to say? What am I going to tell those people, you know? And many of you will say, well, it's your life story. And if you tell the truth, start at the beginning, and then you'll get to where you are. And if you're honest, then it should flow. Right? I'm so grateful for all of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that the closer this has come, the more examples of spirituality and sobriety and community and they have come along. And so I've just got a whole bunch of stuff to tell you. And I promise to have you out of here by the evening news at 10. just kidding. Jimmy. I'll get to him in a second. I want to thank Harris for inviting me to do this. So if I don't do a good job, it's his fault. Okay? So you can blame him for that. I talked at the River Bend group about 3 years ago, I guess it was, and that was a wonderful experience. So my story has changed a little bit. So those of you that were there then, You're probably self-centered enough that it's all new anyway. So, it's great to be back. It's really great to be back, and I'm really humbled by this opportunity. This is a big crowd, and if it wasn't the collective we, I'd really be intimidated by this. But I know that that you're rooting for me, and I'm rooting for you because that's just what we do. I want to thank Ellen and Bob for the wonderful hospitality and being with y'all today, and Jennifer, Milton, let's see, who else? Our other hostess, Marlene, who's our traveling companion, and always love coming to Austin and visiting, and then we usually end up going to a meeting. Let's see, who else? Scott, I don't know where Scott is, but Scott and I, boy, what a connection today to be able to talk to Scott. I talked to him about a month ago, and made a few suggestions. He took them, believe it or not, and we had a great conversation today. And you know that opportunity of where you share with somebody and then you see yourself mirrored back, and the joy of that connection of one alcoholic talking honestly with another alcoholic was inspirational today. I mean, if it was worth the trip to have that conversation with Scott today. And I appreciate it. And just being in Austin with you people and the strong program in recovery that you have. I'm from Houston. Everyone I talked to tonight had a story about Houston. They either lived there, they drank there. Now, didn't everybody sober up there? Well, Milton, you sobered up there and then came up here after 7 months. But everybody, part of their story involves Houston, Texas. So I understand what that means. It's a wild and woolly town and tough place to live, but it saved my life. Throughout my work, I've had opportunities to leave Texas, and I've finally come to the conclusion that if Emmylou Harris or Lyle Lovett don't sing about it, I'm not going. So I think that's probably why we're still here. So. And my buddies from Houston, you're returning our elder statesmen, and I appreciate that. Dottie S. Is back. She started in Houston, was there when I began. Charles was there, so I have to be honest. Charles knows how it was when I got here. And Jimmy B., I guess I was 5 years sober when he showed up, just right after treatment. Now, is this guy an alcoholic or is he an alcoholic? And I mean, you know, he showed up in the, you know, president of an oil company who quit, you know, and he was through with them and all of that, showed up larger than life, you know. I mean, what a wonderful, wonderful character to have in your life. And you know, if there's anybody that's capable of unconditional love, it's Jimmy B. I really believe that, you know, and so glad that we have, you know, we've been down this path a long time, you know, and that's significant. And I want to talk to you about a long time. I celebrated 10,000 days of sobriety last February the 19th. For all of you engineers, it's about 1,120 now. For all you engineers, I can see your mind working. The rest of the meeting, you know, you'll be figuring out how many years. I'll tell you in a minute, okay? Now, for those of you that are newcomers, where's Chris? Chris, I want to really dedicate my talk to Chris, who has 11 months. Where's Chris? Yeah, Christopher's right back there. Got to visit with him. You know, if you've got less than a year and somebody tells you they've got 10,000 days, you got to think about that for a while. You know, and so what, you know, talk to your sponsor, and what they'll tell you is you get a chip at 1 month, then 2 months, then 3 months, and then 6 months, then 9 months, then you get a first year chip, you get an 18 month chip, and then 10,000 days, you get a cake. So, you know, that's the way it works, and then try to figure that one out, you know. I can't believe it's been 10,000 days. And so what I want to do tonight is I want to talk to you a little bit about the disease of alcoholism, how I was, what happened, and how I am now. The disease of alcoholism is a self-centered disease of that will kill you and kill everybody around you sooner or later. And, you know, it says in the big book, you know, we have two choices. We have to go to the bitter end, blocking out reality, die an alcoholic death, or accept spiritual help. And, you know, I've heard speakers talk about, now, how bad is that alcoholic death, you know? Because that's just the way we are. And I didn't start, you know, I don't think we're bad people, we're sick people. And I really do believe that. And we have a disease, and it's alcoholism. But it manifests itself in ways that are cunning, baffling, and powerful. I kind of want to tell you about my journey. I grew up in the most stable family you would ever find in Garland, Texas, in post-World War II Garland. And we bought a house next to the elementary school. I went 12 grades through school with the same people. My mother stayed home. My dad went to work. It was an idyllic growing up time. Garland, Texas, if those of you that watch King of the Hill, is Arland. So that'll give you a sense of what that's all about. A wonderful, wonderful place to grow up. And what happened is alcoholism skipped a generation. My parents have been married 60 years, you know, and it skipped a generation. There was alcoholism on both sides of their family, but they weren't alcoholics, and some would call them unrecovered Al-Anons. And with that comes all the isms. It just comes all the isms. So I'll talk a little bit about that personal responsibility in a while, but it was an idyllic growing up time, and I had the perfect childhood. In my own mind, nothing that I can blame as far as, you know, my parents and all of that. Now, on the other hand, for some reason or another, I needed to drink in the first grade. I just couldn't get one. Now, I don't know what that's all about, okay? I was just always different. I was always felt different. Probably everybody feels different. But for me, it's magnified because I really do believe I was a little budding alcoholic from early, early on. And that manifested itself in a lot of different ways, up through, getting into high school. And at the age of 16, it all changed. And what happened was I found booze, lost about 30 pounds, lost all of the baby fat, found women, and I've been trying to sort all of that out, you know, the booze and the women and everything since then. You know, but my life changed below the spillway at White Rock Lake in probably the summer between my sophomore and junior year in high school when I had my first drink of beer. I had two, and my friend had two, and we threw up, and then drank one more and went home. Well, I was off to the races. You know, I had found something that provided me the ease and comfort that I needed to make it. And it worked. It worked magnificently. And I went on and was successful in high school, went to college, joined the fraternity, was a big man on campus. You know, but it all revolved around drinking and having fun, and it was a lot of fun then. And you know, and I remember our ideal, you know, my idea of a fun time was to double date with a fraternity brother of mine, and for us to go buy a case of Old Milwaukee Quartz for $4, and I'd drink six and he'd drink six. Now I'm sure that really turns all you women on, you know, what a fun time, right? But it was fun for me. And that worked forever. You know, that worked for so long. I mean, I went through college and went into the Army Reserves. It was during Vietnam, went to the Army Reserves, continued to drink, and it was still fun. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, and I don't know when we crossed that imaginary line. That feeling that I'm different. This isn't, you know, it's not going to impact me. You know, I'm not going to have a problem with alcohol to the point to where you cross that line and you know it's a problem and you know there's nothing you can do until play it out until the bitter end. And I don't know when that occurred. I don't know if I was at the alcoholic stage or whether I was at the choice stage when I met Anna, and we were in Dallas, and she had a date with a fraternity brother of mine and was at a party, and I stumbled in. I didn't know he was there. I had a date with these twins, and I was looking for booze and found it there, and she was kind of like, ugh. You know, God, who's that? Introduced me, fraternity brother introduced me. One of her girlfriends said, oh, that's Zach. I don't know what happened to him, you know. But anyway, that was Dallas, Texas. Now, the next time I was at the reserves that weekend, drunk and hungover and coming back, it was a Sunday night. And boy, I was really tired and I was really pitiful. I was just really strung out. So we went out with a group of our friends, and I was so pitiful. It was love at first sight. And to tell you a little bit about Anna, I was in a meeting, and one of her students, one of her ex-students, she was school teacher, and one of her ex-students was there from about 10 or 15 years ago, and I said, you know, oh, hi, how you doing? I remember your name, because I used to help her grade papers. I remember your name, and do you remember Ms. Hodges, don't you? And she said, yeah, I remember Ms. Hodges, and just broke my anonymity, but that's okay. And I said, well, what'd you think about her? She said, I think she's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And so, and I agree with that. And so we've been married 34 years. Is that right? Is there 35? 34. Okay. And we've been married a long time. She tells a heck of an Al-Anon story. And I'd like to talk about Al-Anon for just a second, those of you that are here in Al-Anon. Doug D. in Houston, you know, I'll get into this in my story, but we have really, really strong Al-Anon in Houston. And Doug D. in Houston says, be real careful about making fun of Al-Anons because you never know when you're going to become one. And guess what? Many of us have become one. And so I am so grateful for that program and for it being on equal footing with Alcoholics Anonymous and us being able to work both our programs. You know, the blessing is that two people in a family can have a program. And it takes everything that it takes. And so we were off to the races. I was so pitiful, you know, I looked like a project waiting to happen. Boy, I had potential you wouldn't even believe. And I told her about it. So, man, I was, you can tell an alcoholic is his lips are moving. And so we were going to town, get that screened-in porch and have three or four kids and just ride off into the sunset into a perfect world. And all along, you know, the disease of alcoholism is a part of that and is going to crush and destroy every bit of the sweetness that we had from the beginning and had the potential of building upon. It kills your spirit and it'll kill everybody else's spirit. Again, I don't know when I crossed that imaginary line. We went to Fort Smith, Arkansas, where our first daughter was born. We were there 3 years. I came in one day and I said, boy, I've got to get back to Texas. You know, I can't take this. So the closest I could get to Dallas was Houston. So we packed up and moved to Houston, Texas. And I told her, I said, you know, this will probably be a lot better experience for us because, there's so much competition. The cost of living will probably be less. And, you know, and we'll be just, you know, one more time, it'll be just fine. You know, please always believe my intentions. You know, my intentions are really sincere that, you know, I intend for it to be right. You know, that's my intentions. But that's what I want to be judged on, is my intentions, not my actions. And so the nature of the disease of alcoholism, I want to talk about it for a second. Well, no, I'll wait for a second. Anyway, we moved to Houston, and then things started happening. Our relationship was rocky. I don't know why. You know, my sponsor who died, Ed D., says every alcoholic marriage is a sick dependency. And I think you have, and so if you have that sick dependency, and if you're in an alcoholic marriage, both people have to recover from that. And that's a real challenge. And it was certainly, has been a continuous challenge for us. And with the help of you people and the benefit of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, we've been able to be married, raise our children, and be happy, joyous, and free together and be as complete as we've ever been. And I'm really grateful to have Anna for a partner. But, you know, hitting bottom, you know, the only thing, even the consequences of our alcoholism don't get us here. We had an opportunity to talk to this guy. We were part of a retreat center, a little talk Thursday, and he was talking about, you know, if you're alcoholic, consequences have to add up. It's, you know, if you have one DWI, you know, that's not enough, probably. You know, have two, three, you know, it just goes on. If you're alcoholic, consequences continue. And, you know, and I remember that. The truth is, I mean, from my perspective, if I drink every day and get drunk every day, and there's 30 or 31 days in a month, and I only get in trouble once or twice, those are pretty good odds, you know? It's not bad at all. But alcohol began to take its toll to the point to where physically, I just couldn't go on, and I'll kind of cut through the pain of all of that. One time, and I've just recently been aware of this again. I remember going over one morning to the liquor store, buying a bottle of wine, getting my car, and you know, getting in the car, pulling up to a stop sign, taking a drink of that bottle of wine, and behind me was a coworker. And, you know, I don't know if he saw me or not, if he saw that bottle of wine, but the sense of shame and the sense of despair and that incomprehensible demoralization that only an alcoholic knows, you know, just overwhelmed me, just came over me. And I had no other choice but to continue to drink that bottle because that's all I knew that would work. That's all that worked. And so physically, I hit the wall. When I went into the hospital in Dallas, Texas, and somebody looked at me and said, "You're alcoholic," I said, "Yes." They put me in the hospital and didn't know if they could save my life. I had 40 pounds worth of water weight. I was a wreck. Now, at that point in time, I had two jobs. We were buying a house. You never had a DWI, never been arrested. But I was dying, and the clock was ticking on whether I was going to make it or not. And, you know, I could just see, you know, the drama of it all on my tombstone. You know, here lies Zach. He just wasn't very good at life. You know, just pitiful. Because, you know, the nature of the disease of alcoholism are such that I can't hear you, I can't see you, and I can't touch you. You're not there. You know, all I know is you as a thing or a person or something, that because the feelings are too painful. The feelings are too painful. You're not there. You can talk to me all day long, and I can't hear it because it's way too painful. There's no way I can accept the reality of how I am, and we never know how sick we are. So, you know, it's a miracle that anybody sobers up. I mean, it really is a miracle that anybody sobers up. So the disease and trust, you know. Alcoholics don't trust anybody. I remember this newcomer coming into our meeting, and she said, "I really need to share something with y'all." And we said, "What is it?" And she said, "You know, I don't trust anybody." And everybody started laughing, you know. And we said, "Well, no, we're not laughing at you. Trust is our number one issue. That's our number one issue. We can't trust anybody because we don't trust ourselves. And what you want me to do is impossible. It's impossible. I cannot do what you want me to do. And so there's nobody I can trust." Well, I got out of the hospital, and the doctor in the hospital, and I asked the physician, "What about AA?" And we still don't know where that came from. And the doctor said, "Oh, no. That's not nearly sophisticated enough. He's a professional person, and he needs intense psychiatric inpatient treatment for an extended period of time, and so he's going to have to get this in-depth therapy and be separated from people." And then So on the last day I was in the hospital, he came in and he said, "Okay, I'm going to let you go, but I'm going to write this letter, and I really recommend that you get some help. And if you go back to Houston, you're not going to drink anymore, are you?" And I said, "No, sir." No way. And I meant that. You know, I really did mean that. But, you know, if I don't have any tools, if nothing has come, you know, if there's not anything different, I don't have any choice but to drink. And guess what? I got back to Houston, Texas, and got drunk, and then got drunk again. And then we really started having some problems because Anna got scared, you know, because she knew I was going to die. The clock was ticking on the 6 months. You know, and so through a series of miracles, she called our priest. I was passed out on the floor one night, and she called the priest at our parish that evening, and And he answered, and he said, you know, I don't know anything about alcoholics, but there's a group in Houston at the Holy Name Retreat that help alcoholics. And if you'll call them. So she called him at midnight. There happened to be a priest that was walking by, visiting priest who couldn't sleep that night. You know, didn't have cell phones or answering machines. So a visiting priest that was walking by answered the phone and said, yes, they help alcoholics, but call back in the morning. In the morning, she called back, got us an appointment at 10 o'clock, and I followed her over there, and we went in, and we were sitting in front of a priest, Father Carl, and he looked at me, and he said, are you alcoholic? And I said, yes, and yeah, I'm alcoholic. He said, you want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, yeah, and he handed me a big book, this one, and said, you go out in the patio and sit under the tree, and he pointed to her. He said, and you go into the Al-Anon meeting that's right across the hall. And she went in there, and then when the Al-Anon meeting was over, he got us back together, and he told me to go to AA. And what a miracle. And he was my chief mentor for many, many years. And so I started going to AA. The first AA meeting I went to, I drank wine, sat in the parking lot, and watched people go in. Because I could not fathom, I couldn't believe that there were people who drank like I did that didn't drink anymore. I couldn't imagine that. And so I didn't know if you had to wear a big AA on your T-shirt, some kind of scarlet letter, you know. I mean, if this is kind of like a Hunter Thompson thing, you know. If somebody, you know, Hunter Thompson came in here tonight and saw these people in T-shirts, he'd say, oh, my God, you know, you got to wear a T-shirt to be in this fellowship. You know, they can spot you, you know. And so anyway, I did not know. I did not know what, I could not imagine that it was possible for people not to drink. The next day I drank wine, sat in the parking lot, but I went in. And I went in and got a desire chip. It was the old Post Oak Club when it was over on North Post Oak in an apartment building. And I went there and drank. The next day, but I went back. I kept going back and I kept drinking. And then I showed up. By the way, my home group is the Tuesday night Chapelwood meeting at Chapelwood Methodist Church at 8 o'clock. I've been going to that meeting this summer just about every Tuesday night for 28 years. For that, I'm eternally grateful. And I started going to that meeting and continued to drink. There were a lot of people in AA that hurt my feelings, you know, because I kept drinking. You know, they'd say things like, you know what, we're going to put you in a hotel room and buy you all the booze you can drink, and then we're going to leave you there till you say uncle, you know. And I remember Bill M. talking about, you know, I was sitting there, and I remember him talking about, you know, he said, I just wanted to get away, and so I got on an airplane and flew off by myself for a week and, you know, spent time, and then I came back, and I thought, oh, my God, how can you get on an airplane and go be by yourself and not drink? You know, I could not understand that. Well, I continued to go to AA, and I went to some retreats. The Holy Name Retreat has men's retreats. And the first retreat I went to was in September of 08, September of 1980, 08 backwards. And I went there, and there was this big guy from Bastrop, Texas, Dutch Schultz, who had just lost his wife. And Father Carl assigned Dutch to me. Because he had just lost his wife. Now, what I heard in that was that I was supposed to help Dutch with his grieving. Now, the reality was that Dutch got a wet drunk who was me to help him with his grieving. So that was the reality. I figured that out a couple of years later. But I was the wet drunk that Dutch was assigned to work with, because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when all else fails, we work with others. And so Dutch worked with me. Well, I made it till noon. On Sunday, after lunch, I went out and drank in the car. But you know what happened that weekend? The men of AA, at that retreat, the collective we of Alcoholics Anonymous blew me away with their spirituality. You know, the eyes are the windows to the soul, and I saw what they had in their eyes and knew it was real. And so I went from, I can't do this, or it's impossible, to they can do this, and they're sober, and they certainly have something I want, but I can't do it. And I continued to drink. And then it was a Friday night, October the 3rd, 1980, that I was drunk. Anna was driving. We were going to a meeting, and we were on the Southwest Freeway in Houston, Texas, about probably Bel Air, that Southwest Freeway. And I was drunk, and she had had enough of me, so she put me out on the Southwest Freeway. And the other part of that story is she said, get out. And being a good alcoholic, the first thing I did was reach and pat my billfold to make sure I had my American Express card in my pocket. Because alcoholics are all the same. We're never without that last option. You know, we never get down to zero options. You know, we've always got an ace in the hole. We're like, please, I can't do anything. I can't, you know, the whole time you're patting, you know, you've got a plan. You know, you've got an out. I mean, please don't let me out. But, you know, and then I went ahead and got out. Now, I wasn't going to get out of that car if I hadn't had any money or an American Express card. She might have put me out, but I didn't want to get out of that car. So I went over and had a few drinks, and the Astros were playing, and then I started thinking, well, how am I going to get home? You know, we lived about 20 miles away, but you know, what can I say? We're con men. I talked somebody into taking me home, and you know, and they were didn't tell them where I lived, you know, and they kept driving and finally got me home. Well. And so I woke up the next morning, and I went out in my golf bag and had a bottle in my golf bag, and I took a big swig, and this profound peace came over me that said, Zach, you don't have to do that anymore. And I knew I was going to be okay. And that was October 4th, 1980, and I haven't had a drink since. And neither have I had a desire to drink since that time. I had a spiritual experience in which the compulsion to drink, one moment I had to drink, and the next moment I had this feeling that everything was going to be okay. And that can be nothing but the grace of God for an alcoholic like me. And that's what it took for me. You know, I mean, God knew I had to have a spiritual experience, and that's what happened. Now, I want to tell you the other part of that story. Anna describes putting me out on that freeway, on the Southwest Freeway, as her moment of surrender. And that she went home and went to bed and went to sleep and had let me go. I don't think that's an accident. I don't think there's an accident that her letting me go in her moment of surrender and my spiritual experience coinciding. I don't know what would have happened if she hadn't let me go. And so that's a two-part miracle. The first 2 years were wonderful years. You know, we had a meeting And I want to thank all my friends from Houston for coming up tonight and being with me in this. It's really special that y'all went to the trouble of doing this. We had a meeting last Sunday night, and this guy said, I really do think in 6 months I've probably got better sobriety than you old timers with 20-something years. And that's the truth, I think, in a lot of ways. I think that early recovery where it's new and fresh, and it's working for you. And it's kind of like you have a class of people that you come in with and you get to know them. It's part of your life and you look forward to the meetings and you're active and you're getting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and God's working for you and how wonderful that is, that first 2 years, being on that. And it's not even a pink cloud. It's being carried by the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that's what happens to us. And so I want to go through pretty quickly the steps that we go through and that I went through and continue to work. And I really do believe that I worked the first three steps at that point in time. But every step is a surrender step. It's not just the first step. I think you have to be alcoholic to have the courage to work these steps. And it's hard. And it's involving trust. And we come in, and I have such profound respect for those of you that have the courage to walk through those steps. I just have the utmost of courage because we have to be as sick as we are in order to move through those steps. And what do the steps do? They lead us from self-centeredness to God-centeredness. And so I loved my first couple of years in AA. And the only problem is that I had a sponsor on the other side of town and loved my little group, but I wasn't working the steps. And so I got confronted by that. Somebody said, hurt my feelings again, and said, have you worked the fourth step? Well, kind of, I won't tell you how ugly they were. But anyway, so I made an appointment at Holy Name Retreat Center to work my fourth step. And so the fourth step is really four parts. It's the list of the resentment list. It's the fear inventory. It's the sex inventory, and it's everything else whatever you need to get rid of, okay? It's the fourth part, miscellaneous. So it's really four parts, but I didn't understand that. So when I was at one of those retreats earlier, I'd gotten down on my knees and surrendered as best I could. And out of that came my spiritual experience. I did it again at that retreat. I got down on my knees and I surrendered it to God. I said, God, it's up to you. You've got to help me this. Because I'm the kind of person, I'm sure you can't relate to this, is I don't want to climb that hill till I know what's on the other side. And I want to do this by myself. And AA is an oral tradition. You can't do it by yourself. There's all kinds of drunk traps. You cannot do this program by yourself. Somebody has to help you do it. It's just the way it works. So I was trying to do it alone. But anyway, I sat down and I started writing, and I'd prayed and got down on my knees. And I started writing, and I said, I grew up, and this happened to me, and I had my parents and this and that. And I said, and my brother and I were never very close. And I looked at that, and I said, He's 10 years younger than I am. Whose fault is that? And that was the first time I had ever gotten in touch with my self-centeredness, that I was able to accept responsibility for my part in the disease. And so at that point, the rest of it became pretty clear and pretty easy. And I did the fifth step with Father Carl. And I'm here today to tell you that there's not one thing I've done in my life that I have not shared with another man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no secrets as of today. And so that I've done other fourth and fifth steps, and I'm grateful for that. Those of you that are wrestling with the higher power, I'd like to talk about that for a little bit. You know, I came in, I was pretty neutral about God. I was the oldest male child. I was a good red-blooded American boy. You know, I was supposed to solve my own problems. If I couldn't solve my problems, they were unsolvable. There wasn't anybody to help. I mean, that's just the way it worked. You lived with it. And but it never crossed my mind that God had anything to do with anything. I mean, you know, I was I went to church, but you know, I never had God in my life or anything. And you know, and so when I had that spiritual experience, boy, I was, you know, there was no question in my mind that that's what it was. And you know, and I'm real grateful that I had a neutral position about God, because a lot of us in here have to relearn about our higher power. You know, we have to give up that childhood God, that condemning and judgmental God, that doesn't work for us, and to transfer to which is for me many times, and I don't know who God is. I don't know if it's you people. You know, the longer I'm in, the less I have a concept of what or who or she is or anything like that. You know, but I do know that God automatically forgives me and loves me unconditionally and wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. I know that. I know that. So I really want you to hear me, that I had it easier, because a lot of you've got to give up some false notions, and you've got to get a new higher power. You know, you've got to get a new higher power. So borrow somebody's higher power. You know, if it's working for them, let that be your higher power. If the group's working for you, you know, whatever it takes, just don't drink and let it go. Because what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, you put yourself in the center, you will work the steps. The steps will work to you. You will get sober, and you will have that spiritual awakening that we talk about in the 12th step. So I worked the fourth and fifth step. And then in the sixth step, you know, that's the steps that Bill says represent, you know, that where we separate the men from the boys. You know, that's where we begin. We've named our character defects. We know what they are. We turn them over to God. And God either removes them or he doesn't remove them. You know, he doesn't render us lily white. And so what happens when we have the awareness, and then we have the acceptance, and then we have the action, but the action doesn't work, and those character defects remain. You know, the only way those character defects can be removed is one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're just not rendered lily white. So that's why we have to keep coming back. You know, I love it when people will say, well, I'm working on it. Well, if you're working on it, then you're not in the program. You know, because 6 and 7 is not about you working on it. It's about you working 6 and 7, about you getting entirely ready, or me getting entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character, and then me humbly, with all the humility I can muster, asking him to remove those defects of character. I can't change myself. I couldn't get myself sober. The only thing I can do is work these steps and stay close to Alcoholics Anonymous, and guess what? My life gets real different. It gets real different. And so, I heard somebody say in a meeting a couple of weeks ago that she was saying, man, I've got a problem with this, I've got a problem with that, I've got a problem with this, I've got a problem with that. And her sponsor kept saying, what step are you on? What step are you on? You can't change that. You can't manage well. It's the nature of our disease. We can't manage well. Seemingly no human power could have relieved our alcoholism or our character defects, but God could and would if he were sought. So it's a spiritual solution. It's not you managing well. It's not you stopping something. It's about you doing something different, and then those defects are removed. And I don't know about you, but I still got a bunch of them. And guess what? New ones are coming into my awareness, you know, and they're adding words to the big book and the 12 and 12. And, you know, and that's, it, you know, 27 and a half years going on 28. So what can I say? As far as steps 8 and 9, you know, again, I was still didn't have a sponsor that, you know, I was kind of hit this hit and miss. And so I went to a guy, I had enough humility at that point in time, said, I'm really having problems with 8. And he said, well, did you make a list? I said, no. He said, well, why don't you start there? Why don't you make a list like it says? That's okay. It kind of hurt my feelings again, you know. And I said, okay. And so anyway, I made a list. And I remember early on, you know, and the pain of what I'd done and the lack of clarity of what I'd done and everything. And Anna was talking to our daughter one day about my alcoholism, and I had a fit. You know, I said, God, why are you talking to her about that? I don't want her to know. You know, oh, my God. You know, I mean, that's denial. You know, because she was right in the middle of it. And I believe she still is suffering from the disease, you know, my disease of alcoholism. I believe it had its impact. So I made direct amends. I made formal amends to the people that were on my list. As we're instructed to do. It's good to do living amends, but you do direct amends as well. That's the way I was taught. So I've done that, and I've done it more than once. And I want to share with you, I have two girls. We had a daughter who was 6 years old when I came in, and then we have a sobriety baby, our trophy to the world of what recovery looks like. You can have sex after you, get sober, and so we have our sobriety baby who's 25 and Chrissy's 33. And Chrissy went to the University of Texas and hit her bottom here and has a strong alanine. I told her alanine story, you know, I mean, it was, I laughingly asked her the other day, I said, I'm going up here to Austin to tell my A story. You want to come tell your alanine story? You know, she did that. She went to Alateen, and she has her own Al-Anon program for her own issues, not because of me, but for her own issues. And so I made direct amends to Chrissy twice, and we have a wonderful relationship today. She went to the University of Texas, went to Tulane Law School, has been very successful, went to New York. And decided to make a move because New York was overwhelming. Went to San Francisco, took another job there. Tells you a little bit of something. She went from one coast as far as she could get to the other coast as far as she could get. And we were talking and so forth about my youngest daughter, who I tried to detach from. Wasn't very pretty. It was necessary, but not very pretty. And she said, well, Dad, remember when I was hitting my bottom in Austin? And I called you and I said, would you help me? And you said, no, Chrissy, I can't do that. And what that's all about for me at 27 and a half years is I don't remember that. Now, I don't remember if I was too self-centered to remember that or if it was too painful. But either way, guess what? New material for me to deal with. And if any of you are experts at launching your children, would you please see me afterwards? It's just never pretty. It's just never easy around here. And, you know, and so we have Chrissy, UT, women's studies major, philosophy major, University of Texas, who lives in San Francisco and does her own thing. And then we have Emily, who went to the Texas A&M University, is a born-again Christian and works at the local Baptist church in Houston, Texas. So, you know, I've got my liberal feminist daughter over here, and then I've got my little born-again Christian over here, you know, and nothing in between. You know, I mean, that tells you something. That tells you something right there. So anyway, so we're having a heck of a time of launching Emily. I'm having a heck of a time of launching Emily, and that's real painful. And I need to let go of her and detach, and so I'm taking appropriate action to do that. But I do feel like they have a sense, she loves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you something. She went to meetings from the time she's born. My friends Barry and Kathy W. came up with their new daughter, Gabby. And Emily was right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous from day one. And you know what that is? At 25, she's got about 50 healthy aunts and uncles who have known her all her life and love her unconditionally and are always glad to see her. And so AA and Al-Anon, that's what you've done for my children. When I couldn't be a good parent, you were. When I couldn't love them unconditionally, you did. And Emily, there is nothing in the world that she'd rather do than go to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing in the world she'd rather do. And what she says is what she always says, is it cake night? You know? But thank you for loving my children when I couldn't love them. And that's the way we do things. 10, 11, and 12. I'd like to talk about that. Now I have a spiritual director. I work my AA program, and then I get outside help through spiritual direction to grow along spiritual lines. We have a spiritual retreat next, 11-step retreat next weekend that we're going to attend. You know, the counseling problems that I went to a therapist, I got outside help earlier on. Now I go to my spiritual director for those kinds of issues because they're now spiritual issues rather than interpersonal issues. Still interpersonal issues, but they have a spiritual dimension to them. And I think as far as, you know, the whole concept of 10 and 11 and 12 and continuing to grow along spiritual lines and rejoining the world and being one, walking the path of what God wants us to have. God wants us to have, be happy, joyous, and free. And I have a banquet. I feel like my work now is such that it's this banquet that is laid out before me that I love to do, and I can just choose whatever I want. You know, one point in time, I really had to deal as a character defect with my ambition. You know, I'm competitive as hell. And I had to deal with that, with my ambition. And somebody reminded me, why can't that be a gift of God? Why can't you be of maximum use to people and be ambitious and that just be who you are and be competitive? That's okay. That's who you are. That's okay. You know, use that. Don't let that be wasted in God's economy. You know, use that to maximum benefit to your fellow man. And I have a wonderful job in which I really consider it a ministry. You know, it's an opportunity to be of service to my fellow man, have meaning in my life, and it's just wonderful. And I'd like to talk a little bit about sponsorship. I sponsor people. I have 27 and a half years. Most of my guys have like 10 to 20 to 25 years. And so, what I get is stuff like, oh my God, I'm having relationship problems. You know, my employees to act up. You know what I mean? High bottom problems, folks. High bottom problems. You know, but they're real. You know, and that's okay. And we all do this together, and it works just fine. I want to show you something. Found a couple of pictures. This is my sponsor, Dad Jimmy, and my sponsor, Ed D, and his sponsor, John H. from California. And this was at Ed's 30th birthday party in Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 generations of sponsorship. And what a miracle to be sponsored and to have people that I sponsor and then they sponsor people as well. And so I think I can get to 6 right now. And my sponsor came along at 2 years of my recovery, Ed D, who manifested in himself in my life as a larger-than-life character, a very quiet person from Comfort, Texas, who had been in California, engineer from Texas A&M, who loved me unconditionally. He treated me like a son, never criticized me. Now, he bit his lip a lot. You know, he bit his lip a lot, but never criticized me. He made a decision on a daily basis that he was not, you know, he was going to be, he was, he, and he, those of you that saw the great Santini, that's the way he describes himself with his children. And he made a decision he was never going to do that again. And Ed died a year and a half ago, and I was there at the hospital when he died. Betty is Anna's sponsor, and you know, when I couldn't get Ed on the phone, I'd talk to Betty. You know, and people do that today, that people can't get me on the phone, talk to Anna. What a wonderful, you know, either one of them will do, and either one of them are there. But Ed was a larger-than-life character, and he really, in his quiet way, you know, he never wanted to tell a story, and that's why I got to tell mine. He'd be standing there, and he'd say, no. He said, no, I don't do that, but he does. And so I got to tell my story a lot. And, you know, and what a wonderful, wonderful relationship. I had a great relationship with my father, but to get the blessing, and Marcy White and Bob White, Marcy talks about the blessing, that if nobody ever gave you the blessing when you were growing up, if you never received it, guess what? You can get it here. And what that blessing is the unconditional love of another human being who sees in you who you're becoming, who sees in you all the best and the brightest of who you are and loves you unconditionally just the way you are. And when you get that blessing, there's nothing that equals it. And it's part of that spiritual domain that we talk about. And so I got the blessing from Ed, I've gotten the blessing from Betty, and I've gotten the blessing from a lot of other people in Alcoholics Anonymous who have been with me and walked with me. You know, we move from I, little I, to we. You know, we do this together. We do it. And I want to talk a little bit about meetings and the significance of meetings. You know, showing up tonight is a surrender. You're teachable. And you knew what I was going to talk about. You knew I was going to talk about the solution. You knew I was going to talk about how I lived my life in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you knew that that I was going to bring my highest good that I could possibly muster to you to meet your highest good. And that the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we can all do that. And here we get inoculated from alcoholism, but we also get to experience the presence of God as a community. You know, you can't get this by yourself. You know, it's the we of the program. You can't do this by yourself. You can't do it alone. You've got to have help. And so what you get as a result is this wonderful, wonderful community that we celebrate every time we go to an AA meeting. And that's what's infectious. That's that twinkle in the eye of the men that I saw at the Holy Name Retreat Center that had something that I wanted, and I was willing to go in any lengths to get it as best I could, and that I ended up with it too, and what a blessing. Where am I now? You know, I'm at the point now to where in my my spiritual advice. Oh, and let me talk about this. You know, I've got a new sponsor. He's got 7 years less in the program than I do. He's a good garden variety alcoholic. He works the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. He believes in going to meetings. He believes in applying the principles of the program. He's there for me. He helps me. And, you know, and that's what sponsorship is for. And so I have a new sponsor. We're learning how to work together, and that's a wonderful, wonderful relationship. And I do believe that that as sponsors, it's our responsibility to have a sponsor. You know, there's some basic, you know, there's You know, in the traditions, it talks about the difference between the bleeding deacons and the elder statesmen. You know, I'm not going to, you know, and you probably know some bleeding deacons. And, you know, anybody with, if you go to a meeting with one person's name attached to it, that may be a bleeding deacon. Whereas the elder statesmen stay in the background, they respect the group conscience, they allow the group conscience to manifest itself in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they are worthy advisors, and there's nothing more important than the future of Alcoholics Anonymous in maintaining the traditions of the program. And that's to me, is an elder statesman of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where I am today is the message is real clear, go deeper. You know, I think that, you know, it's not an accident that we call this, you know, in the 12th step, they talk about a spiritual awakening. Well, if you have an awakening, doesn't that imply that you've been asleep? You know? And I think a lot of you can probably relate to that, you know, I was asleep. I was frozen, whatever you want. I've been thawing out for going on 28 years. You know, and that awakening is a spiritual awakening. And if you work these steps, and if you're willing to go to any lengths, you will have a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And you will have the opportunity to practice these principles in all your affairs and carry this message to other alcoholics. And what a magnificent opportunity. So, you know, going deeper, you know, what Ed would always tell me, you know, when we get in trouble, intensify, go to more meetings, do more work, do more prayer, you know, and I wander off the path, you know, it's a spiritual path, but I wander off, you know, I mean, I get back into self, you'll hear me say, well, I'll be working, you know I need to work on that, you know, I know I need to do that, and what that means is I'm not ready. I'm still in the pain, and I'm willing to live with it till it becomes unbearable, and then I'm willing to do the work. Okay, but you know, I get off the path, and so what's the solution? Intensify, get in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, go to more meetings, do more prayer and meditation, work with people, work with others. You know, I'll bet everybody that was of service tonight at this meeting stays sober. You know, I guarantee you, everybody that had a part in service at this meeting will stay sober. Now, so if you're having a problem with sobriety, you know, guess what? Be of service. I bet they could use some more people. See Harris. I meant to tell a Harris story. And you'll like this, Jimmy. Harris and I go to Colorado and we hike together. And this last year we hiked up and down the hill. And we were talking all the way along. We were talking about our relationships, our marriages and so forth. And so for 3 hours, you know, we talked along and we you know, and then we got up to the top. And then we came back and we talked some more, and we figured out what it's about. You know, what relationships are all. You know, what the essence is. You know, we figured out the truth about our relationships and our marriages, and I want to share it with you. That we're alcoholic and they're females. And Milton and Jimmy, and I mean, you know, that's about as much as we know, isn't it? Well, you have, well, okay, if you really want, you know, Jimmy's got some answers. He's got plenty of experience in relationships. Boy, I've been a part of them, man. I tell you what, that's adventure. It's adventure, you know. So anyway, what a gift. And, you know, I want to conclude with two things. One is I was reading in my spiritual literature, not conference approved, but a 13th century philosopher, Heifetz, who made the comment that, let me think about it for a second. that there's nothing great, that if God knocks the chair out from underneath my mind and I free fall into the hands of God, there is nothing greater in this world. And that was in the 1300s or the 13th century. So for those of you that have worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what that's like, getting that chair kicked out from underneath you and free falling into the hands of your higher power. And I thought, you know, so this is not new stuff. But what a blessing that we have the opportunity to experience that. Can you imagine being average? Can you imagine just kind of having a drinking problem? Just, you know, it's not that bad, and being left with what you had before you got here. Can you imagine that? What a horrible, horrible existence. And so the last thing I want to say is that a good friend of mine in Houston, and he talks about this. He says that, you know, he said, let's see, what is he said, the road gets more narrow, but the view is magnificent. And so thank y'all for being here tonight. And I want to ask you to do one more thing. The next meeting that you lead it on miracles. Just say, okay, let's all talk about miracles tonight and just listen to the profound truth, you know, that we have available to us in this program. In our ability to know our higher power and to allow Him to work in our lives. So thank y'all so much for inviting me here. I appreciate it.